Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to We Are Free TV, the channel of the people, by the people, for the people, where we talk about different subjects, anything from aliens to channeling to alternative medicine, fifth dimension, raising of the frequency, alternative this, alternative that, anything which helps people and helps them raise their frequency and open their hearts and open their minds to new technologies, to new healing methods, and many facts that might not have been promoted heavily in mainstream media or any other sources. This is the place to find out all these amazing things. I'd like to thank the people who have donated and donate, and I encourage you to also donate, because that's how we manage to stay in partially independent. We have our own website, our own server, and we do upload our videos to other places, but you never know these days how safe that we are there. That's why it's important that we stay independent, at least partially. And these things cost money, so thank you very much for your donations. All the information is shown up here. And I would also like you to please share this interview wherever you possibly can, on Twitter, on Facebook, send it by email to people, on Twitter, on LinkedIn, on WhatsApp, on Telegram, etc. Thank you very much for that. You're also advised and encouraged to go to our website, wearefree.tv, and then click on join us and enter your email, and then you'll be on our mailing list. So you'll be notified by email every time a new interview is released. Also, we have a Telegram group called No Censorship TV. Please do join the group. Highly appreciated and very helpful for you, to you, because you will be notified whenever a new interview is released. So today, my guest is Gerald H. Pollack, PhD, who is no ordinary man. He is a professor of bioengineering, University of Washington, Seattle. The name of the interview is Does Water Have a Fourth Phase? A talk with Gerald H. Pollack on the fourth phase of water, light, energy, connection to the ground, and more. So, hello there, Doctor. How are you today?
I'm great, and I'm even greater with the opportunity to speak to you and your audience. I'm delighted.
Amazing. Same here.
So, happy to be here.
Perhaps you could tell us a bit about yourself, a background, or anything like that.
Okay. Well, you mentioned I'm on the faculty of University of Washington. I'm not a popular faculty member among students, maybe, but among other faculty, I'm not so popular because we've made several discoveries that tend to step on some academic toes. They deal with water. So I've been there all my entire career. You know, it's a beautiful spot in Seattle, and people don't like to leave, and I'm one of them. I spent many years, a few decades, studying the molecular mechanism of muscle contraction, how your muscles develop force and how they shorten at the molecular level. And then I came to realize that something was wrong with the current theory, because of a bunch of reasons. One is the fact that nobody ever talks about water, and that's weird, because the muscle, like other kinds of cells, two-thirds water. That's two-thirds by volume. If you do the count a little differently and line up all the molecules in the muscle, or pretty much any cell, and just start counting one by one, it turns out that more than 99% of those molecules are water molecules. And the reason is they're so small, and so to fill that two-thirds volume, you need a lot of them. And it struck me as odd that 99% of the molecules, not only in the muscle cells, but other cells of the body as well, really are that they are thought to do nothing. It's like the water in the bathtub that in which you bathe, you know, it just sits there and doesn't really do anything.
Is that the mainstream accepted fact, what you just said, or is it something you discovered, or what, that it just sits there?
The mainstream view is that the water doesn't do very much. Uh-huh. It just sits there. You read any physiology or cell biology book, they'll open with the idea of water, chapter one, and then it never appears again in the book. It just doesn't do anything according to mainstream views. But it does, and the evidence is, I think, pretty clear. And it appears the evidence that it's central for all of biology appears in a book that I wrote in 2001. It's not my latest book, an earlier one. It's called Cells, Gels, and the Engines of Life. Hmm. And the book demonstrates that water, especially the kind of water that is structured, organized, different from the ordinary water, liquid water that we think about. We'll go into that in a moment. This water it exists and in fact dominates in every cell in your body. And that water is absolutely central to every major bodily function. Now, it's not in the textbooks. However, the evidence, I think, is pretty clear. And I opened this discussion by saying that I'm not so popular because my views tend to be somewhat radical. But I think based on evidence.
Well, let's look at the evidence. I mean,
yeah, of course.
Is that to do with the fourth phase?
It has to do with the fourth.
What do we have? The first one is gas. Then we have, what do we have? We have liquid. And then we have frozen
solid,
like frozen water. And the fourth one is
in between a solid and a liquid. It's you might call it a liquid crystal. It's a kind of water where
sounds where like a drug. Liquid crystal.
It is, in fact, it's probably the best drug that you can imagine because. Yeah. This fourth phase, which I'll describe in a moment, is the water that fills your body. It has the consistency of honey, roughly, and you can. It's actually easy to imagine because think about. Suppose you're shaving, and I can see you're well shaved, so you must have shaved this morning. But if you happen to shave with an ultra sharp razor, you might have cut yourself. And if you cut yourself, if the water that's inside your body is liquid water, even a simple cut, the water would come pouring out. It's like if you take a pipe and put a hole in the pipe, the water will come pouring out. But that doesn't happen, right? There may be some blood that comes out and it quickly coagulates, but you don't lose all the water in your body.
Yeah,
and which implies that the water is not really a liquid and it's in your body. It's gel-like. And so what does this mean? What kind of water are we talking about? We never heard of gel-like water. And it's what we call the fourth phase. And so what we discovered, I should say before I tell you about our discovery, that this is not a new idea. The idea that there was that there might be a fourth phase beyond the usual three of water. It's 100 years old. It started with Sir William Hardy, who was a famous colloid physical chemist. And he must have been pretty important because he has Sir before his name. So, you know, what he espoused. And he came to a conclusion. He said, look, there's a problem with water. We make various observations, and many of those observations are unexplainable by the idea of three phases of water, and therefore there must be a fourth phase.
Yep.
But he was not able to define it. And there were various people who came after him who talked a lot about so-called structured water, not the least of whom, I should say, was Albert St. Georgi, and that name may or may not be familiar.
Nope.
But he was a Hungarian scientist who won a Nobel Prize for discovering vitamin C, and many scientists consider him the father of modern biochemistry. An amazing guy who was so creative and so instrumental in various findings. And he knew about this kind of water, and he knew that it was so important for life. And one of his famous aphorisms, there are so many, one of them is, life is water dancing to the tune of solids. So he knew that the water was central for everything that goes on. And then another person who spent his life, he just passed just shy of 100 years old, was a guy named Gilbert Ling. And so Ling spent the better part of his life espousing the idea that the water inside your body is not ordinary liquid water, as we just discussed. It's a so-called structured water. And his idea is that the structure of the water was just simply water molecules stacking upon one another in some ordered fashion. And what the evidence that we have suggested that he was not accurate exactly on that, but the general idea of water structuring, I think not only from him, but the people I mentioned who preceded him, it was there. It's been there for 100 years. And so when I say that we discovered something, we're standing on the shoulders of giants.
Yeah.
So what did we discover? Well,
who's we? If I may ask, who's we?
Well, when I say we, I talk about the students and postdocs in my laboratory at the university. Mm-hmm. It's always we. The word I is like a foreign word in my language.
Okay. Just,
because it's a cooperative effort. Mm-hmm. You know, the students are the clever ones. They do all the work. They make the discoveries, and I'm sort of the guiding hand who attempts to make sure that what they write in manuscripts is intelligible, which is a challenge sometimes. If any of them are watching, they'll be snickering about that because I'm a taskmaster. The stuff that comes out of our lab has to be clear and understandable. Mm-hmm. It's sort of, you know, the theme of our laboratory.
What else do you do now that we're talking about the we? So other than doing what you just said, is there anything else you do, like encouraging them and pointing them to go where no man has gone before, and supporting them and giving them courage and support, or what?
Well,
or
I hope
saying,
that's
no,
true.
Don't go there. That's dangerous.
No. That's rare. I think if it's a good question. I think if there's one issue that comes prominently, it's whatever subject a student or postdoctoral fellow is working on, it has to be one of very high significance. Because if it's of low potential significance, it's not interesting. And, you know, I don't see them spending hours, years, whatever, working on something that generates yawns. It's got to be something that's potentially very interesting. And the idea of water having a different or fourth phase is central for everything. Yeah. It's not just central for what happens inside our bodies, but it's central for what's out there, ranging from oceans to clouds,
okay,
to rivers. And you know, if it's there, it's got to do something, or yeah, it plays a role. And so if you're trying to understand any of these, you got to know what's contained therein.
You had a theory,
okay,
and then you found the water and said, "Oh, look, it's gel."
It was something like that. Excuse me, something like that. I had the good fortune in I think it was late 1980s or early 1990s to meet the gentleman I mentioned, Gilbert Ling, at a conference in Hungary. And I was really impressed. He made a real impression on me. And also there were a dozen other people at that conference who had evidence to support his point of view, the point of view that, that the water inside the body is different from the water in the glass. I was impressed, and I flew home, and I was so impressed that I thought, I got to write a book on this subject because Gilbert Ling's books are virtually impenetrable. He had the capacity in his brilliance to think that everybody was equally brilliant, and he'd sit down at the typewriter, no word processor then, and he'd type out, and that was it. That was the book. There was very little editing. It didn't have to pass muster. He just had these various ideas and evidence that he would present. That
what evidence? Can we have like one or two examples? Because I'm curious to know.
Nuclear magnetic resonance, for example.
Everybody knows
water inside. Well, that's just one piece of measuring electrical potentials in cells. And let me tell you that the more, shall we say, advanced evidence would,
yep.
because I think some of his ideas are not exactly correct, but I was really impressed. And so I gave one of his books to my favorite students, and they came back to me and said, you know, if this guy is right, this is critically important. It's so foundational for all of biology and, in fact, all of nature. So I was buoyed by their positive remarks, and I went ahead and wrote the book that I mentioned in 2001, Cells, Gels, and the Engines of Life. And the idea underlying that book was to present the ideas of Gilbert Ling, to make them intelligible to maybe even lay people, but people with at least just like you, yeah, but you're way beyond.
I wish.
Well, you're also modest. I was incented to write the book, and I wrote the book, and it received mixed reviews. Some of the reviews said, wow, this is just more of Gilbert Ling, and we know that he's a crackpot, and so pay no attention to it. And at the other end, one of my favorite ones, a guy from Harvard University, it must be true if it's from Harvard University, he said, this is a 304-page preface to the future of cell biology. I like that one.
Why is it so important that this phase exists? So what? So water is gel and not liquid. Who cares?
Good question. Who cares, and why should you care? So I think many of us are interested in understanding how the body works.
Yeah.
Right? Accept that?
Totally.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So if you want to figure out how your car works, you got to understand the role of the engine, right? And the transmission and the brakes. You could drive the car, but you won't understand, unless you know all that, you won't understand how it works. And so it's the same for the cell. You got to know what's inside, how it's organized, what happens to the stuff inside. And without that information, you're stuck.
So what's in it?
I'm not sure if that.
So what's in the gel water? Tell us. I'm so curious to know.
Maybe it's best if I loop back and start from the beginning. What is this kind of water that we're talking about?
Please.
And I hope it becomes interesting. Please ask me again. Okay.
Okay.
So what is this water all about?
Yeah.
What we discovered is that if you got a container of water and you put some material in the water, it could be a gel, could be some polymer material, anything that is so-called hydrophilic. Now, hydrophilic means water-loving. So it means that if you have a surface and you put a droplet of water on the surface, it will spread out. Okay, as opposed to hydrophobic, water fearing, like Teflon, which doesn't spread out at all. It balls up, and so if the surface is hydrophilic, then here's what happens. So here's the hydrophilic surface, and the water meets it. And as the water meets it, the first molecular layer of water undergoes a transition. It transitions from ordinary water, you know, the H2O molecules bouncing around at a fierce number of times per femtosecond. A very active dance. It undergoes a transition to a sheet-like structure. And if you look at the structure from this direction, it looks like hexagons, a sheet of hexagons. And then that sheet forms the basis for the next sheet to form, which is just like the first sheet, but slightly displaced.
Sheet?
Well, and then the third one.
If you look under a microscope, you mean?
If you could look under a microscope, in this direction, you'd see this honeycomb structure, like a beehive. Okay. Very, very common throughout nature. The problem is that you can't exactly look at the microscope because these structures are really tiny. But you can infer what the structure is. So essentially what's going on is that the water molecules, undergo this transition, first layer, second layer, and so on. These layers keep building, and experimentally, we've seen under certain circumstances up to on the order of millions of these layers, and that translates to millimeters, sometimes even more of extent. So we're talking not of a trivial amount, but a huge amount. So that's one feature, and we found that this water, as it grows, it's like a crystal. And perhaps you know that as crystals grow, it's like as ice grows on a glacier, it pushes out everything else because that had been in the water, because the crystal is pure. And in order to get something pure, you've got to get rid of the impurity. So as this grows, it pushes everything out. In fact, that's what we use to measure the extent. We put little tiny spheres in the water called microspheres, and we can watch the microspheres getting excluded from this. So this fourth phase, when we first discovered it, you might say by accident, but of course we knew what to look for. Because it excluded, someone suggested we should give this phenomenon a name, and we called it exclusion zone. And it really works well in US because the abbreviation is EZ, which is easy to remember, but in Israel, I guess, and elsewhere, it's EZ. Am I right?
Mm-hmm. Not no, EZ, in England.
Oh, England. Okay. Well, whatever. Yeah, so in many countries. Anyway, I refer to it, or we refer to it, as EZ water, the water that's in here, or fourth phase water. It's the same.
And all this is from one drop, you said earlier, this the crystallization, no exclusion thing?
No, it could occur in one drop, but we mostly take a bath of water, and we put a chunk of this material in the bath, and we look to see what happens at the edge of that, and we see this growth and exclusion.
Still, what?
Okay, yeah, I'm getting there. you remind me, this is Israel.
Arrogant.
I know. No, not arrogant, but questioning.
Inquisitive.
I tell my friends that Russia often. Inquisitive, after the first slide of a presentation, questions arise.
Get to the point.
Yeah. in Japan, you have to actually struggle to get one question after a seminar. They're so polite, you know. Yeah. You know. Anyway, I'm really happy I'm getting to the point.
To be interviewed by a Jew from Israel. Go for it.
Yes. I've got plenty of relatives in Israel. They're not so different. okay. So there we go. So Now, I'm getting to the point.
Please.
So, point is, this water is not neutral. This easy water actually typically has negative charge. Why does it have negative charge? Because it actually forms, each layer forms from water molecules that split. So a water molecule is H2O, or H plus OH minus. And what happens to form these layers is that the OH minus and the H plus split, and the OH minuses build this layer and every subsequent layer. And so these layers then acquire negative charge. So your question is, oh, where do the positive charges go? And the positive charges are beyond this zone. So you've got easy water here, and then you've got ordinary water filled with protons. This is negative. This is positive. It's a battery. So okay. First point of significance is wherever this forms, you've got a battery. And if you put electrodes in, and we've done it, demonstrated, you put electrodes in, you get electricity out of it. You get electrical current out of it.
Okay.
So from a practical point of view, we're not getting to biology yet, but we're getting there. From a practical point of view, you could get electricity from water, and there's one more factor that I'll get to in a moment. But basically, you can use water, a renewable resource, to get electrical energy. But your question must be now, you can't get something for nothing, right? You're going to ask that question.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, okay. So you got to put, in order to create a battery, to charge a battery, it's sort of like the battery of your cell phone. You know, if you plug it in at night, the next day it's working. If you don't plug it in, it's not working anymore. So it's not unique. Your cell phone is not unique. And everything requires energy. You don't get something for nothing. So where does the energy come from to build this kind of water and to separate the charge? And the surprise is, you can't plug it into the receptacle. It's got to come from somewhere. And we couldn't figure it out. I must admit, for a couple of years of head scratching, that's why I've lost a lot of my hair. We couldn't figure it out, but a student figured it out. An undergraduate student took the chamber where he had this easy water growing, and he found a lamp right next to it, a gooseneck lamp. He took the lamp and he shined the lamp on the chamber. And he called me in to see what happened, and where in the illuminated part, the easy or fourth phase was growing rampantly, a huge increase in the size.
So the sun?
So I said, well,
the sun? Is the
sun.
Source?
Well, the sun is really the ultimate source of the energy. It's coming from the sun.
Perfect.
And of course, we did experiments to figure out which wavelength of sunlight or any light is most responsible. And we studied a range of wavelengths, starting from the short ones, ultraviolet, through the visible spectrum, and then the infrared. It turned out that ultraviolet had almost no impact on the size. It has other impact. Visible light began to have a little bit of impact, but infrared had 1,000 times more
impact. But infrared
is
bad for you. Didn't you know
that? Who said so?
I saw it on the TV.
Well, if you saw it on TV, it must be correct. but how many people are taking infrared saunas? How many people are purchasing this for good health? How many people in Russia and Finland are sitting in the real saunas or bandhas in Russia? It's filled with heat. Heat is essentially infrared energy.
Okay.
They soak up this kind of energy, and bad for health.
So if I buy
infrared
light bulb, which I could get in every hard store, hardware shop, can I do something with it? Can I just shine it
absolutely
on myself?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you'll find if you read the literature, the medical literature, you'll find, I don't know if it's uniform views, but it's all over, and people are buying these infrareds on it, which basically is an infrared light that they use to shine on themselves to simulate what you might get in the real sauna, or as they say, sauna in Finland. And the effects, I don't know if you've ever experienced one. I have, and I can tell you truly that sometimes you walk in and you feel practically dead, and 20 minutes later you come out feeling alive. The difference is remarkable.
We found out that water is a battery, and it's fueled by the sun or the infrared rays of the sun, and it gives it energy. So the water in the body is energized, which means what? How does that help
which
me,
means
the
that
human?
The electrical energy, which exists all over your body, and you can measure it sticking electrodes in. It's been done for 70 years. It's not controversial. This is actually potential energy that your body can use. Mm-hmm. And this is really an important important insight. And nobody knows how much, because the prevailing view is that your energy comes from a molecule called ATP, adenosine triphosphate. That view has been challenged. Most people don't know that it's been challenged. And the challenge, nobody's ever responded to that challenge. The challenge came from the same Gilbert Ling, who actually quotes some chemists who said, the guys who thought that ATP has a special high energy phosphate bond, they made a mistake in their arithmetic. They screwed up. And Gilbert Ling has quoted that, and nobody, to my knowledge, ever responded to that. And so we just take it as fact that your energy comes from the splitting of ATP to get the chemical energy. We don't know if that's true or not true. And inside your body, you've got enormous amounts of electrical energy that could be used to power essentially all processes in your body. So what's unknown now is the extent to which this electrical energy is used by our bodies to do all the work that our bodies do. So if you're asking for the beginning of potential significance, it's that. That's just a starting point. And let me just add, where does the infrared energy come from? It is ultimately from the sun. However, it's everywhere, infrared energy. If you were to darken your room so you can't see anything, and your cell phone camera can't record a video, it's dark, and you whip out your infrared camera, whose sensor is sensitive to infrared, you'll see a beautiful image of everything. And soldiers use this at night to see in the dark. So everything is generating infrared energy. So outside your body, the sources of infrared energy are vast. Inside your body, they're also there because your metabolism is generating heat. And that heat is essentially equivalent to infrared energy. So you've got infrared coming from outside and coming from inside to build easy water throughout your body to build this potential energy, which you ultimately use to power all the things that you might do, including shaving and running and jumping and you name it.
Okay. So is there anything that damages this water, as far as you know?
Yes. We do know, experimentally, we do know that one thing that we know pretty much for sure damages it. Do you know about glyphosate? I'm not sure. Okay. Roundup?
Can you describe what exactly you mean?
Israel. It's a weed killer. It's the most prominent weed killer throughout.
Okay.
Well, what I mean is
Weed killer.
It's chemically called glyphosate. GlyphosateI think I've got my spelling right. And it's a controversial kind of issue because in various places, I don't think Israel, because I've tasted the vegetables and fruit, and it's incredibly good. And I think it's free of any kind of chemicals. Maybe I'm.
I still buy organic in Israel. I don't trust the normal supermarkets.
Okay, well then the organic should be, it should be free.
And now I'm starting to grow my own.
You're smart. You're absolutely smart.
Thanks.
Probably the best ever. But here in the U.S., Roundup is really common. I used to use it myself in the backyard. It's a weed killer.
Yeah.
And so the way it works is you first genetically modify whatever vegetable you're growing so that it's not sensitive to glyphosate. Glyphosate doesn't kill it. So the vegetable grows beautifully, and all the weeds get killed. And, you know, what else could you ask for? This is fantastic. You're killing off all the enemies. However, the problem is that, when we take some corn, delicious corn, especially, is really, almost all the corn here is genetically modified and sprayed that way. You take in glyphosate, yourself. If it's a poison for weeds, it's probably a poison for you. Yeah. I've been tested. My body is full of that stuff, even though I try to eat organic, and it really impairs health. Essentially, it's a poison. So we tested this poison. We tested to see whether the poison diminishes the amount of easy water, and it absolutely does. We're happy to hear that, because in the same study, we tested various nutrients, herbs, what have you, that are known since Ayurvedic times, 5,000 years ago, to be good for health, like turmeric, for example, holy basil, and other stuff. They all increased the amount of easy water, but this poison diminished, no matter what.
Anything
no
else?
Matter what quantity.
Anything else is no good for that water.
Well,
we
haven't specifically tested, but you know, my guess would be that that various pharmaceuticals in the water would probably do that. But this is speculation.
And I'm lead sure. lighting.
No, I. Well, LED, LED, right.
Yeah.
Lighting. So if it's in the infrared part of the spectrum, it should do the opposite. It should build that. And according to the evidence
The blue light.
Yeah, blue light, which I, of course, always try to get rid of when I try to sleep in different places, because it has a really powerful anti-sleeping effect for me anyway. Our experiments have shown that blue light has no particular effect on easy water. It doesn't expand it. It doesn't diminish it. When you go to the longer wavelengths toward the reds, it tends to have a positive expanding effect. And infrared, as I said, is the most powerful of any that we've examined.
So. What about memory? Is there any evidence that water has memory? And if so, why would it? For what purpose?
Huge evidence, and not trivial evidence. I'm hesitating because it's a long story, and I don't want to take up all of this this interview on the subject. But
is it relevant?
Let me just say,
The memory thing.
Sorry?
Is it relevant to what we're talking about?
It is absolutely relevant.
Listening then.
It's completely relevant.
I'll focus you. Don't worry. I'll focus you.
thank you. You keep me on target.
Please. So memory. Water has memory. What do you know?
Yeah. Because I guess also because of the software. I'm sorry?
I'm saying water software has memory.
The industry in Israel. Yeah, well, a lot of people knew. So the most prominent person who knew and who got crucified, well, he was Jewish. He got crucified. His name is Jacques Benveniste. And Jacques was a famous French scientist. He died prematurely, unfortunately. And Jacques was actually a friend of mine. And he discovered that water had memory. He did experiments to demonstrate that, without going into detail. The essence of the story is that I submitted a paper to the journal Nature, and the editor said, it's got to be bullshit, because it can't be that water has memory, because, you know, the molecules are dancing around at a furious pace and they're randomly oriented. There's no capacity for memory. So so he said, it's got to be wrong. And then the Office of Nature felt a lot of pressure from Paris, where Benveniste was working, where there are a lot of homeopaths, because this involved serial dilutions, which the homeopaths do for a living. And they were thinking that, oh my goodness, you know, this famous scientist, Jacques Benveniste, an immunologist, found evidence to support what we do every day. And so Nature was feeling a lot of pressure. And they called, and when I visited Jacques, he said, on that phone, I got a call from the editor of Nature. So he picks up the phone, and the editor, Sir John Maddox, says, I'll make a deal with you. I'll publish your paper, but the condition is that we're going to send a committee of peers to your laboratory to look over what you've done and report back to our readers. So the committee of peers turned out to be a kind of odd committee. It was the editor himself, who was a physicist who never made it to his PhD, became a journalist and worked his way up. A guy from the National Institutes of Health, who was an expert in studying fraud in science. So they suspected something. And the third guy was a guy called the amazing Randy, James Randy, a famous magician. So you kind of get an idea of what this committee was looking for, and sure enough, so they spent a few days there in the first couple of days.
Let's say I don't know. So what were they looking for?
They were looking for cheating, for fraud.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Okay.
Yeah, because this was seemingly impossible that water could have memory.
Yeah.
So it turned out that they found fraud, and the evidence is that when the technician did these serial dilutions 2 days in a row, everything worked just as reported. But when one of the visitors, the fraud buster from the National Institutes of Health, did the dilutions, it didn't work. And so they concluded that, well, when the French do it, it works. When we do it, it doesn't work, and therefore it must be a trick. However, you know, James Randi is probably the most famous magician in the world. He's famous for being able to discover the tricks that the other magicians use.
So what, you guys filmed it? The French filmed themselves doing it, and then they showed the tape or the CD. However, they brought to see if it's just a trick?
And like they were visiting the laboratory. They were looking over their shoulders as they did the experiment. They could see everything that was going on. They couldn't find the trick. There was no, the world's greatest magician found no trick, but they concluded that it must have been a trick, because when they did it, it didn't work.
How do you explain
it?
And what exactly were they doing? What does the dilution do? How does the dilution prove that water has memory?
Well, if you dilute, if you take a substance and you put it in water and you dilute it, say 1 to 10, then you have 10 times less of the substance. The concentration is reduced by 10 times.
Yep.
And what the homeopaths do is they do serial dilutions. They dilute 10 times or 100 times, and then they shake it. It's called succussion. They shake it like this, for example. They do it again and again and again, and they'll do it so many times that you'd think, according to convention, there should be nothing of the molecule left, only water. And it turned out Jacques Benveniste, and now confirmed by many laboratories, found that the diluted sample is pretty much the same effect as the original, even though it should have been pure water.
So it had less of the substance itself, but the actual effect was as if, because I heard, I have a friend, she's a homeopath, and I think, and she told me that the more you dilute, the stronger the remedy. They call it remedy. The stronger the, yes, remedy is.
Yeah. That it seems to be the case, or that certainly at least as strong. From the evidence I've seen, it's not exactly as simple as that. It's a bit more complicated, but in essence, yes.
And what influence were they testing? What was the influence?
Well, they were testing. They actually did it on many different biological systems, multiple ones. And the first one was some cells that would secrete histamine. So, you got the cells, and you pour some antibodies on it, on these cells, and immediately they secrete some material. Well, histamine is a material, and it's a very specific reaction.
Yep.
And what Benveniste found is that you can dilute it, and then pour the diluted one, and you get the same result.
That means water has memory. Unbelievable.
That means water has memory. And okay, so this was the end of the Benveniste career, because you can imagine he was demoralized, and he was considered to be a scientific joke. And the joke is, you're having trouble with your memory, just drink some of Benveniste water and you'll be just fine. Hmm. Because it's got a memory. But more seriously, I organize each year, last year the exception because of COVID, at the annual conference on the physics, chemistry, and biology of water. It's in near Frankfurt, in Bad Soden, really nice place. And each year we have 2, 3, 4 presentations by people who have evidence that water can contain memory, different kinds of evidence. So it's in our conference of typically 200 people or so. It's common knowledge that water has memory, but if you, and by the way, this is now being studied also by a distinguished scientist who won a Nobel Prize. This is Luc Montagnier, Nobel laureate for identifying HIV. And he was a friend of Jacques Benveniste, and he continued in that vein. And his results are amazing, if true, and it seems that the results are true. May I tell you what his result
is?
Yes,
please.
Yeah. Okay, it has to do with DNA. So you take a short strand of DNA, and the information is contained in the sequence along the DNA, and he puts it in water. He actually dilutes it a few times, but we can forget that for the moment. So you got water plus DNA in a sealed flask. Sitting next to it, also in a sealed flask, is pure water, the best, purest water you can get. Two are sitting right next to each other. And Montagnier claims that the information from the DNA or from the water surrounding the DNA is somehow being transmitted to the nearby container, both of which are sealed. So he takes this informed water, he's been sitting here for a day, takes this informed water and performs the PCR test, the standard amplification of DNA. And he gets lots of DNA, and the DNA has the same sequence as the original that was sitting here. It boggles the mind, but the guy's got a Nobel Prize. He's a respectable scientist, and apparently the results have been repeated by two other Italian laboratories.
Mm. Okay, so if, now we know that this is, water has memory. Sorry, did you finish
water
with
has,
the DNA?
Yeah, and so
yeah.
Well, it has memory. So your question might be, how is this possible if the water molecules are bouncing around all the time? How could it possibly store information? Well, it probably can't. However, the easy water can, because easy water is a crystal, and the memory in your thumb drive or your laptop computer. That's a silicon crystal, and silicon crystal consists of transistors that are spatially organized in three dimensions, here, and so on, three dimensions. And each one of them has two different states, which you know, you call zero or one or on or off or whatever you like. And this distribution of zeros and ones gives you the information. It stores information.
Did you just say that you're trying to explain how come, although the molecules are bouncing around in water, and I'm like, well, how can it have a memory? So you're saying, well, because, I mean, normal water might not, but the easy water does. But that contradicts what we just said, because you just said that traditionally, and even my friend, the homeopath, make remedies by diluting water, and that proved that it has memory, not in crystal form and not in in easy water form.
Well, no, we don't know that, in fact, that the diluted has no easy. In fact, it probably does, has a lot of it. Without going into detail, the evidence for anybody who chooses comes from Alexander Konovalov, a distinguished Russian scientist and academician who was the rector of his university and head of a big chemical institute. His work, translated into English, now, he passed, unfortunately, this year, a few months ago. Brilliant work, and it implies exactly that water does have easy in
it. So the body has easy water, and every water has easy water, not just the body.
No, not every water. If you probably reverse osmosis water, probably doesn't have or doesn't have very much of it. Some waters have more than others. There are tests.
But that's where the memory comes from. The water used by the homeopaths has easy water in it, probably.
I believe it does.
Yeah, it
the evidence is not conclusive, but I think it does. Okay. Yeah.
Now let's tie everything together.
Yeah, I want to tie it back together. And so the easy water that I talked about is a regular array, just like the computer memory array. And does it do the elements of that array, do they have different states? Well, all you've got is oxygen and hydrogen. It turns out that oxygen has not two, but five different states, the so-called oxidation states. And the one that this is in every chemistry book, it's not exotic or anything. Mm-hmm. The one we learn about in school is -2, but there's also -1, 0, +1, +2. So it means that easy water has essentially the same capabilities, although not fully understood, same capabilities as a silicon-based memory, a thumb drive that you stick into your laptop. And I think that is the basis of the memory. It lies in the easy water. It also implies that one day your computer memory may consist of easy water instead of silicon, because the capacity is enormously larger.
But how does that tie in with the battery element of the water? At the beginning, you were talking about that the water has it's like a battery, and it provides energy to the body. Does the memory have anything to do with it? Is it combined in any way or related?
Well, I had never thought about that, but I think a clever engineer might be able to figure out some way to link.
So it's two separate subjects. That's my point. So you were talking about two separate things, and the common thing is water.
The common thing is water, and what I'm trying to get at is that the whole concept of easy water has so many applications. We're just beginning to touch on them. It's I don't know how much time
as much as we like.
Well, okay, let me go into another, and that has to do with the circulation. Okay, here's another. We dealt with getting energy from water. With the memory water, and now I want to talk about the cardiovascular system. So everybody knows that your cardiovascular system is driven by your heart, right? Your heart pumps, develops pressure, pushes the water through your cardiovascular system, and therefore you're a healthy guy. I can see it. I can tell. At least your brain is healthy. The rest of your body, I don't know, but you're
even healthier.
Well, okay. So we found that that story is not complete. There's something else that works alongside the heart to pump your blood. Let me explain. Mm-hmm. And this also has to do, what I'm going to explain also is relevant for agriculture, which of course is really critical for in Israel, where I got to say once again, the vegetables are the best imaginable. Every time I go and eat Israeli vegetables, I feel healthy, renewed, refreshed. Mm. Okay. So what are we talking about?
About the blood vessels and the heart.
I know. It was a rhetorical question. Okay. So it started, started with an observation. I'm sorry. This will take a few minutes. Okay. Because the background is critical.
No problem.
It started with an observation by a student. And I asked the student, we found these, this substance Nafion, which we use a lot in our experiments. It's very hydrophilic, so it builds very nice exclusion zones. So I asked the student to go have a look and see. We found it came in cylindrical form, like a tube of Nafion. I said, check out and see whether exclusion zones form on this curved surface. And he quickly found that, it did. And then a week later... It's called Nafion. It's like Teflon, but it's a variant of Teflon.
Oh, so you poured water over it, and you tried to see...
We put the Nafion in a chamber of water.
Yep.
Okay. With microspheres, which we use, and he was looking for a region where there are no microspheres, where they're excluded. And he quickly reported that, he found it in... next to the adjacent to the Nafion tube, but he found something else. And one day I was sitting in my office a week later, having a talk with someone who I think was a very important person, but not so interesting. And a student comes running in, and usually they're very polite. I leave my door open all the time. At this time, the door was closed, and he opens the door, no knocking or anything. He peeks in and he says, I found something really interesting. I thought I would let you know. What could be so interesting? He said, I've got the tube sitting in the water, and I find that the water is flowing through the tube without stopping. It just keeps flowing. And I thought, thank you for interrupting this boring conversation. I thought, if he's right, and we checked that he was right, this is really important, because pushing water through a tube requires energy, right? And there's no obvious source of energy except the infrared energy that we had already determined is entering into the chamber and building exclusion zones and such and separating charge and all that good stuff. And so it turned out that indeed we figured out the mechanism, and it was something like that. So we found that if you have a hydrophilic tube, and all you need to do is immerse the tube in water, and there'll be flow through the tube. Kind of amazing, if you think about it. And several of the students have pursued this, and we knew it was true. So I took a trip to Russia, knowing about this fairly recent finding. And my friend at Moscow University, Vladimir Vyakov, who's a professor of biochemistry there and vice chair of the department, distinguished scientist, introduced me to his colleague in another laboratory. And the colleague comes and starts telling me in Russian, translated by Vladimir, in Russian. He says, there's a big problem in the cardiovascular system. Big problem, And I'm sort of feeling slightly arrogant, as you guys say in Israel, cutting the clouds with my nose. Because I grew up on cardiovascular system. I did my PhD on the pressures and flows, and I thought we had it all worked out. This guy's telling me there's a big problem. What's the big problem? Tell me. Within 5 minutes, he convinced me that there was a very big problem. And the problem is this. It's so simple. In the cardiovascular system, the capillaries, in healthy young adults like yourself, the diameter of the capillaries is down to about something like 3 or 4 micrometers. Okay, very narrow. But the red blood cells that need to pass through are twice that diameter. They're 6 or 7 micrometers. See, and the question is, well, this is like, you know, having a football, and you pass it through a narrow pipe. To get it through, it takes a lot of energy. And since you've got a lot of red blood cells that need to go through, your body has to expend a huge amount of energy to get that through, to get those red blood cells through. And he calculated, he said, if the heart is responsible for doing this, fully responsible, if your heart is responsible, it would need to develop a pressure that's something like 1 million times the pressure it actually develops. You might call that parenthetically high blood pressure, a million times. But, you know, sometimes having done lots of calculations in my life, I know that calculations can easily be off by a factor of 10 or 100. Even if he's off by 1,000 times, it's still, you need an enormous amount of pressure from the heart. If the heart is really fully responsible for driving those red blood cells through your capillaries. Have to ask,
is that like a hiccup of creation to have the blood cells bigger than the actual tubes they need to travel through?
That's a great question, but you know, because you're closer to the source, Mother Nature doesn't screw up. Everything Mother Nature does makes sense. And so, in order for those red cells to get through, they have to do this. And you can see it on videos. They slither through, not in their usual donut shape, but the donut is squeezed to get through. And the very fact that this happens, it must have some functional implication. And I think the functional implication is that the edge of the cell must be touching the capillary wall. And the only way to assure that is to make sure they're in contact as the red cells pass through. This is my speculation, but I think, you know, that's why I think Mother Nature did it that way.
Just checking.
Okay, so this guy is telling me there's a big problem, and I said, well, what do you think is the solution to the problem? And he had various ideas about bubbles in the cardiovascular system and in the capillaries, and I don't know, but I'm thinking, you know, we just found that you have a tube, a hydrophilic tube, that water flows right through it, and the energy actually comes from infrared energy, building easy, separating charge, and all that good stuff. We had already figured that out. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, is it possible that this could apply in the cardiovascular system? You know, you've got capillaries just like these tubes, hydrophilic tubes. So we did experiments to test this, and we're about to publish the experiments if a journal will accept it. And experiments demonstrated that, we tested the signature feature of this phenomenon in an actual cardiovascular system, that if you add infrared energy, the flow will get much faster. And if you diminish infrared energy, it slows down or stops even. And we tested that. It was a chick embryo, and we got positive results suggesting that indeed, the same phenomenon that we found in the laboratory, that this so-called spontaneous flow through the tube is occurring in your capillaries, maybe in your larger vessels as well. And there is a lot of evidence, other evidence that supported that evidence. For example, a half dozen different groups have reported over the last century or so, even earlier, that if you stop the heart, the flow doesn't stop. Mm. This is a surprise for you. It was a surprise for me. You could knock me over.
Does it stop forever, or just for a minute, or for an hour?
The group, the latest paper, 10 years ago, I can't remember their names. They were doing experiments on mice, and they at the end they sacrificed the mouse by clamping the aorta, and the mice complied by dying. Seconds later, heart stopped, and they found that the flow was continuing 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 30 minutes, more than 1 hour.
So why did it die if the flow continued?
Well, that's a question of, is it, well, the flow is reduced. It's not the same flow anymore. Yeah. It's greatly reduced.
okay.
But it keeps going. And so if it keeps going, something is driving it. Mm. And that's what we were discovering. So the conclusion that we've been able to draw is that in your cardiovascular system and my cardiovascular system and everybody else's cardiovascular system, there are two drivers, not one. It's not just the heart. It's the heart and it's also the vessels themselves. Both are contributing. Both are driving the blood through
with
your cardiovascular
system.
With
easy water, obviously.
And easy water is central to all of that because easy water forms on the surfaces of those tubes. And there is indirect evidence for that. Another Israeli, I can't remember his name, more than 50 years ago, discovered that, and the big vessels, that the red blood cells that are flowing through don't want to go near the surface. There's a gap, and that gap we think is the exclusion zone. It wasn't known at that time. The red cells don't want to go there because it excludes everything. The red cells are flowing in the core, not around the periphery. Nobody knew at that time what was the reason, but now we have a better idea that you got an exclusion zone here, and the exclusion zone excludes everything, or essentially everything.
Yeah.
So the red blood cells are flowing in down the middle.
I see.
So, okay. So this is like a third implication, which I think has some gravity to it, because, and also some potential for a therapeutic maneuvers, because it could be that all you need to do is apply some infrared and you can actually restore or enhance the circulation.
And where? On my face? On my heart? On my shoulder?
Probably everywhere. I have to think this through, and of course,
do you do it?
It's all speculation on my part based on what we see in the laboratory, but every cell in your body has easy water, and every cell and that easy water can be built just by exposure to infrared energy.
So I can buy a spotlight and screw a infrared bulb to it and just direct it to my face for 10 minutes and then to my chest and then just slowly all over my body, a few minutes to every part.
You could if you want to, or you can purchase an infrared sauna, which is then exposing your entire body simultaneously.
Saves time.
To it. Saves time. Yeah. We all want to save time. So
is it possible?
Anyway, that's yet. Yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay.
And agriculture too. So, question, about how does the water get to the top of the tall trees? I don't know how tall they are in Israel, or how tall some of them get, but we have redwood trees, here, 300 feet, 100 meters tall. And the question is, the water starts at ground level. It's absorbed by the roots. And how does the water get up to the top of the tree? This is a problem that's been debated forever. You can imagine taking a tube, an empty tube, and laying it on the earth, filling it with water. Let's say, three meters or so high. Filling it with water. Which way does the water want to go? Does it want to go up or down?
Down. Well,
of course it wants to go down because there's a huge pressure. And now take one that's 100 meters tall. The same problem, but even worse. But the water manages to get up there, right? How does it do it? And this is an unsolved problem. However,
it is now.
I think it's the same mechanism that's happening in the xylem tubes. In fact, it's been demonstrated they have exclusion zones. I have a picture in my more recent book, which is called The Fourth Phase of Water, which describes much of what we're discussing, much of what we're talking about in detail. It even has cartoons. My son is an artist. and people have commented on the artwork in the book.
Amazing.
I hope they think the artwork is not more interesting than the written stuff.
Yeah. But, you know, who knows?
One never knows.
Yeah.
So yeah.
What
so
about
this-
harvesting energy from charged water? Is it possible? And does this actually allow cheap energy for everyone? If it was possible.
Yes. Yeah. So then we can circle back to what I was talking about the battery-like effect, the separation of charge, and we could demonstrate in the laboratory that we can stick two electrodes in, one in the negative, one in the positive, and we could light an LED. Now, it doesn't take a whole lot of energy to light it, but the principle has been demonstrated. The problem is to go from demonstrating something in the laboratory to creating something practical. And, we're invested, so to speak, in trying to do something meaningful and practical for the world. The world is in big trouble. And we think that this is possible to do it. However, people who have been in industry, business, whatever, they're very familiar with the so-called Valley of Death, which is a very deep valley. You have to cross over to go from laboratory demonstration to something that's practical and useful. Mm. And so this will require development, which in turn will require investment because, to hire the people to do the work, the research work and development work, it doesn't come free.
I think Tesla, the actual scientist, not Elon yeah. Musk, talked about energy, producing energy from water molecules in the air or something.
I have heard about that, but I haven't read it. It doesn't surprise me, and there are some scientists who are moving in that direction. Some plants do it. There are some plants that grow without roots, that, for example, grow on copper wires, some kind of moss, and they get their water from the atmosphere, from the humidity. And there are also people who claim to, perhaps you know the people who claim that they don't eat. And there's one in India who claimed that he didn't eat or didn't drink any water for something like 65 years. And of course it sounds preposterous.
But they tested
it's very
him.
Humid.
They tested him in labs and they got all these scientists actually.
Absolutely. Verified. And in fact, I got the guy who did the testing, we became friends. He was going to send his daughter to my laboratory, but somehow it didn't work out. And they gathered together something like 15 medical people to look at this guy. They put him in a room, tested him, and they measured everything they could measure without piercing his skin because he wouldn't allow that. And they concluded, they observed him for, I think, 10 days or something. He didn't drink. He didn't eat. And they did many, many tests, which they showed the results of those tests at our conference. And at the end, the most amusing part was he was in the hospital room, which is was on one of the lower stories. And this guy had his office up a few stories above. And after everything was over and he was fully tested, the chief investigator wanted to chat with the guy. And so they ran up the stairs. And this guy was running after not eating anything or drinking anything. For 10 days, he ran up the stairs faster than the doctor could run up the stairs. Was the backstory.
Well, after not eating for 65 years, you mean?
Well, he said allegedly. 65, but of course, he lived in a cave somewhere in the jungle. He said he was approached by angels who told him that all he had to do was meditate and pray, and he didn't have to eat or drink anything.
But it was more than 10 days. It was years.
No, it was 65 years. And then after 65 years, he came to the government to report everything that had transpired.
He said they ran
of
up
course,
the stairs.
Not many people.
He said he ran up the stairs faster, having not eaten for 10 days. But in actual fact, he hadn't eaten for years, not just 10 days.
Well, we don't know if that's fact because nobody was there to check.
Well, presuming he's not lying.
Presuming he's not lying. And that's what they were trying to demonstrate or to test to see at least if he could do it for 10 days. And he did.
So what does that mean?
10 days. Well, it means,
Talking about, is it easy water that feeds him?
About getting energy getting energy from water, possibly, and also from light, from infrared light. So he could get his water presumably from the atmosphere, and if this water contains separated charge, he's got energy actually from the water. But also the fact that he's meditating, praying. It's possible, you know, some of the meditators, the scientific tests that have been done on them, everything changes during meditation. It's possible that some of the energy that's being taken in on meditation is energy that the body could actually use for function. Nobody knows that for sure, but this is an interesting hypothesis that's worth testing.
What about walking barefoot on the ground? Any benefits?
Oh, I'm glad you asked that because if you walk barefoot on the ground, you're connecting yourself electrically to the earth. And so you might ask, well, big deal. So
what?
You know, so there is something to it. And that something is that the earth is actually negatively charged. Again, backstory, I started my education studying electrical engineering. No professor ever told me that the earth was negatively charged. We understood implicitly that if we took a plug and plugged it in, that the third round prong, that's different maybe in Israel, it connects you to ground, which is zero electrical potential. And nobody ever questioned it. And then it turns out it's not true. It turns out, I learned, you might say, the hard way. It was only a dozen years ago. It was a Russian guy who had worked in my lab for 6 months, and he was about to depart. As he was walking out the door, returning to Russia, catching his flight, he mentioned something about the Earth's electric field. I said, Andre, you've just misspoken. You mean magnetic field, right? Everybody knows about the magnetic field. Who ever heard about the Earth's electric field? He said, well, I mean, everybody knows that the Earth has an electric field. It's 100 volts per meter at the surface of the Earth. I said, what are you talking about? I studied electrical engineering. I never heard such a thing. He says, in Russia, everybody knows, even middle school students know, that the Earth is negatively charged, the ionosphere is positively charged, and between these two surfaces, you have an electric field that runs down like this. I went home scratching my head. He said that the educational system in the U.S. is deficient. They don't teach that, but in Russia, they all know it.
Yeah.
And I think it turns out to be true, because next day, one of my students brought me the book of lectures of the great Nobel physicist Richard Feynman, who many consider the Einstein of the last half of the 20th century. Graduate students in physics read his books. Probably almost every graduate student reads those books because they're funny. He had a great sense of humor, and they're interesting, and they really explain things. And one chapter deals with the negative charge of the Earth. And he cites all the evidence, well, not all, but the evidence that came before. This was in the mid-1950s. So that was enough to convince me. So now getting back to your question. So the Earth is negatively charged. The evidence is abundant. It's clear. And that is really important for much of science. But what about walking barefoot on the beach? How does it relate to that? Well, your cells are filled with easy water, and easy water is negatively charged. If you've got some pathology or dysfunction, it might arise because you don't have enough easy water in one of your cells or some of your tissues. So if you connect yourself to negative charge, the negative charge will flow into those cells. And the negative charge we found in the laboratory, you have water, you put an electrode in, you add negative charge, builds easy water. And so if you're connecting yourself to the earth, what you're doing is building negative charge, building easy water in those cells that are deficient in easy water. And that will tend to restore them toward health. So when you walk barefoot on the beach, you feel good. And I think one of the reasons you feel good is that you're getting recharged, so to speak, literally recharged with electrons. And these electrons are building easy water. Your body then becomes recharged.
The ultimate treatment would be to walk barefoot along the beach with a portable infrared sauna around me.
Yeah, and you got to be sure that a rocket doesn't come. But it's another story.
Yeah,
it okay. could be. Yes,
so much good interesting for health. Information. I mean, how electrically charged water is related to the weather? Oh yeah, that's
directly related to the weather. And this is a chance for me to advertise my forthcoming book, which hopefully will come out as soon as my son finishes the renovation on his home, when he can get back to work on illustrations. Uh-huh. He's a really talented artist. So I start with a question that maybe you never thought of. What keeps the clouds up in the sky? I don't know if you thought of it or not, but the clouds are made of water. So you take, in theory, you take a long ladder that can get you up to the level of the clouds. You take a pitcher of water with you, and you come to the top of that ladder, and you decide to turn the pitcher over. What happens to the water?
Pulls down,
right? The cloud is built of water. How come that doesn't happen, or doesn't always happen? It does sometimes.
It's a different state. A different phase.
Different phase, but what keeps it up there? So you said it's a different phase.
Lighter than air. I don't know.
Is water lighter than air?
It depends what phase. If it's gas, I guess it is.
Well, look at the cloud up there. Does it, especially a dark gray one?
Ah.
Does it look like a different phase?
Of course. If it's full of water, it's just about to pour down, then yeah, you're right. There's tons of water up there. What on earth is holding
it
up there?
I mean, one person actually computed, an atmospheric scientist, he said people don't really get the impression of how much the water really weighs up there. He did a calculation. He said, let's express it instead of in terms of kilograms or something, in terms of elephants. And he computed that one of these cumulonimbus clouds, you know, the big ones, is something like a million, I don't remember how many million elephants worth of weight up there.
Imagine.
Smaller cumulus cloud might be, you know, 10,000 elephants or something like that. Imagine when it rains.
Yeah. Those raining elephants. Not cats and dogs, raining elephants. But raining elephants.
Yeah, but what keeps the cloud up there from raining?
Easy water.
Well, it is easy water, actually. But there are a couple of steps to get there. But the point is, negative charge of easy water is really... So the cloud consists of droplets, and the droplets have like an onion skin around them to keep them round. And this onion skin, multiple layers, consist of easy water. Negatively charged. So you've got a lot of these actually forming the cloud. And so the cloud essentially has negative charge. And this has been measured many years ago. People don't pay attention to it. The cloud has negative charge. The earth has negative charge. And, you know, we've learned in elementary school that when you have negative charge here and negative charge, it stays up. And if you've got, if you have a cloud that has a lot of negative charge, it stays up higher. And if you have one with less negative charge, it goes lower. And And what happens when it rains is that, well, maybe it's too much to...
That's interesting. What happened? I was going to ask, when does it start raining?
Yeah, okay. Well, positive charge comes from various sources, including evaporated water. And when the positive charge happens to come in the vicinity, it mixes with the negative charge. It gets drawn into the cloud, and the cloud gets lower. And when it gets low enough, then something is triggered that causes rainfall. And what's triggered is induction. You may know this is called Faraday induction. So if this is a surface and I put a charge here, let's say a positive charge, this positive charge induces negative charge on the surface, always opposite charge. And then if this is positive, this is negative, they attract each other. Okay. And so that's what happens in the cloud, that when the cloud gets enough positive charge, it gets low enough that, that there's the induction effect that occurs, and you get opposite charges. This negative cloud, induces, positive charge locally just beneath. It's still negative, but less negative. It induces opposite charge, positive charge here, and the two are attracting each other. And because they attract, raindrops come. You got rain when they attract. And the evidence for this is that the droplets are not just falling, they're actually pulled. And the evidence for that is people have actually published measurements of the speed with which the drops fall. And you'd think that the drops are just, you know, kind of released and they free fall. But the velocity measured using high-speed camera is actually up to 10 times faster than that. And the conclusion of the paper is that these droplets are getting pulled by something.
Interesting.
And very I think they're pulled by because of the opposite charge of locally just beneath. So,
coming back to your amazing discovery, how can it turn the Middle East and the whole world into a jungle full of water and vibrant life?
What a great question. It's already filled with vibrant life, more vibrant than almost anywhere on the surface of the earth. I feel the energy every time I visit. But in better response to your question, I think that desalination is one of the issues, and this circles back to another application of what I am talking about. So I mentioned that the easy water, it's exclusion zone because it excludes everything, and it excludes salt also, according to our measurements. So if you have a system where easy water builds, and you can easily extract easy water, you have a possibility of creating salt-free water. And we've actually been exploring that. Again, we haven't gotten too far, but the idea is you take ocean water and you put it in and you extract easy, which should be free of the so-called contaminant, which is salt.
Can do it. Perfectly pure drinking water.
And not only pure drinking water, but good drinking water, because easy water is good for health. Mm. You're actually drinking the stuff that you need to fill your cells. And in theory, it's free of salt, in theory. Free of salt, and it's easy to make because you don't need any energy except the energy from the sun.
Yeah.
And you're not lacking that.
No.
And so,
thank God.
So for me, for the Middle East, the solution is to go in this direction. The problem is, you know, it's like this valley of death again. You can demonstrate something in the laboratory, but to expand it so that it's in a on a useful scale, it takes a good deal of investment basically money. To do this further and then to develop the technology. Theoretically, it's possible.
Okay.
To get it to work requires that kind of investment. And for me, this is very exciting because this is one of the serious problems on the face of the earth. It's not only not only removing the pollution, which we, you know, can do the same way. There are several patents we have on this, but also getting more drinking water from the ocean. Oceans are, I wouldn't say they're infinite, but there's a huge source of water there.
Definitely.
So it's exciting. Yeah.
Definitely. Very exciting. So, Gerald, we have reached the final stage of the interview. Since we've covered all the subjects properly more than once, and everything's very clear and interesting and exciting, the final stage, the dramatic stage, is where I'm asking you to please address directly from the bottom of your heart your fellow brothers and sisters around the world with a request, suggestion, demand, or any message you wish to impart to them. So the stage is yours. Go ahead, please.
Okay, that's a great question. My answer is truth seeking. It deviates a little bit from, shall we say, the specific theme of water, but it's true in water. And, you know, we've been trying to pursue truth in the field of water, and there are many who are not willing to actually look at the evidence we have, but to declare that it can't be true, because if it were true, someone would have discovered it 100 years ago, which in a sense is true. I'm sorry for the lawnmower outside. I'm staying, but I hope you can still hear me. I think it could disappear in a few moments.
Perfect timing, just before the end.
Well, truth-seeking is important, especially now where disinformation is becoming so prominent that we no longer know what's true and what's not true, what's believed and what is not to believe. And we've developed an organization, put forth an organization that is oriented toward truth-seeking. It's called the Institute for Venture Science. And the Institute, by the way, URL, in case anybody's interested, is very simple. It's IV, like intravenous, ivscience.org, ivscience.org. And this organization is oriented toward truth-seeking. We want to fund with private money in scientific endeavors that challenge the status quo, where the status quo is obviously not working, even though it may be in the textbooks for a very long time. It's difficult for scientists to do this because scientists, you know, they need to feed their families and they need to keep the people in their lab working. And if you want to get money from the government or other organizations, if you challenge the people who are judging your grant applications, it's not cool. You won't get your money. And scientists, canny scientists, know that that's the case. But we've designed this organization to enable scientists to actually pursue the truth, what they feel is the truth. And the truths will produce, if they turn out to be valid, they will produce scientific revolutions. The problem is this, and we've solved this problem, I think. The problem is you, Michael. You say, you know, I've seen satellite photos of the Earth, and it looks like it's a sphere, but everybody around me thinks it's flat, right? And you can't get any money to study your round Earth idea because all the people recruited to judge your application are flat Earth people, and they don't want to be displaced,
yeah,
right? And there's no sense. So you go to our organization, you get funded. But the problem is that as soon as you get more evidence that the Earth is round, someone will pop up and say, "Oh, Michael Bloom, he's a crackpot. Don't pay any attention to him." And then what do you do? Well, you can't raise a flag and say, no, I'm not a crackpot. Please believe me. You know, what our organization does is it addresses that problem directly and it addresses the problem by funding multiple groups. So if we like your idea that the Earth is round and we fund you, we're going to fund a dozen groups from around the world who share your vision and are pursuing the same kind of approach using different methodologies. And then next year at the annual meeting of the Shape of the Earth Society, you've got not only Michael Bloom, but you've got a dozen people from around the world, each using a different method to show that the Earth is round. And it's got to precipitate a scientific revolution, of which there have been few, if you think. There have been lots of technological revolutions, like these headphones and my laptop and your cell phone, your smartphone. I have none. Scientific revolutions that are equivalent to like the splitting of the atom or the genetic code is more than a half century ago. It's really difficult to pinpoint ones that have occurred recently.
Yeah.
We need them badly because any new kind of truth will bring new technologies inevitably, which may help solve the problems of humanity. So the bottom line, after this long speech is, truth seeking, I think, is so important for our existence and our humanity. And the Institute for Venture Science, ivscience.org, is designed to do that. And if anybody is interested, you know, someone who has done well in their life and would like to donate to an organization that's designed to promote the emergence of scientific yep. truth, please contact me.
So please send us the actual URL, the link, and we're going to include it underneath the interview.
Oh, okay. It's okay. I will send it.
Yeah,
to
if you could send it to us, fine. Then Karen can add it. So, wow, what can I say? Gerald H. Pollack, PhD, the one and only professor. What a wonderful interview this was. It was long, but I couldn't feel the time go by. I enjoyed every moment. And I'd like to thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. It's been inspiring to hear your provocative questions. I love it.
Excellent.
Take care.
So thank you so much. And good luck with everything. And to our lovely viewers, what a wonderful and fantastic interview this was. I am sure you enjoyed it as much as I did. Thank you for watching and have a nice day.